Jordan Miles. He's close to 30 years old now, but when he was 18, he was jumped by three undercover police officers and arrested. The charges were dropped, and when Jordan's swollen, discolored face showed up in the local newspaper, there seemed to be a genuine groundswell for police reform. In that community, it's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And what has and hasn't happened since then is where we start. All of the fallout over the last decade may provide a roadmap for reforming law enforcement. What law enforcement reforms, if any, would you like to see in your community? What role do you see race playing in law enforcement? And how do you think we're all going to get to a safer place from here? 1-800-642-1234 to join us this morning or email ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is the author of A City Divided and the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. He teaches criminal law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. David Harris, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
Your first chapter details the story of this one night for Jordan Miles from the perspective of the three police. Your second chapter details the perspective, the story of what happened to Jordan Miles on this fateful night more than 10 years ago from Jordan's own perspective. And you open that book immediately showing us the discrepancy between two different points of view. How do you describe what happened on that night?
Well, on that night, Jordan left his mother's house, as he always did, about 10 or 11 o'clock. It was January, so it was dark. It was cold. And he went to go around the block to his grandmother's house, where he had a bedroom. The family's home was very small. He had three siblings. So that was a good arrangement for everyone. He didn't get more than three houses down when he saw three men come out of a car. And they began yelling top of their lungs, "Where's the guns? Where's the drugs? Where's the money?" And he didn't know what was up, but he knew that he lived in a neighborhood with higher than usual rates of violence and crime. And he was terrified and he ran. And very soon they were out of that car and on top of him, beating him. He was arrested and taken away after he was injured. As you said, there's another point of view here, and it's the officers who say that something very different happened. They saw a male figure up against a building trying to hide himself. They were in an unmarked car in plain clothes there to suppress guns and drugs in a dangerous area. And when they encountered this man, they could tell he was armed. They knew it right away from how he stood and his pocket was weighted down and so forth. And the fight was on when he ran. They didn't find a gun, but they're certain there was a gun there. The stories diverge, as you said. There's two versions. Nobody disagrees that Jordan ran, but Jordan says they never identified themselves in any way. The police say they consistently always identify themselves, including that time that they yelled Pittsburgh police and they showed their badges. Because of this discrepancy, there was eventually not one but two trials in this case in civil court. But what was important here was that somehow this young man who stands 5'6 and 150 pounds soaking wet was an honor student at our city's Crown Jewel High School, the School for the Performing Arts. He ended up under a pile of very large, well-trained police officers. There was a racial difference. He was African-American. They were white. And this really split Pittsburgh. The question of what happened on that night, who was telling the truth about what happened. Jordan was charged with some very serious felonies, which were later dropped. The police officers faced investigation by the federal government, but nothing came of it. But I think the more important questions, the more important things are these. Number one, Jordan survived. We know that not every person in a confrontation with police like this survive. So his voice is very much present in the story and in the book. But number two, it's not just about what happened that night. It's about why it happened. What set this off? And why do things like this keep happening over and over in American cities and towns every day in the United States from 2010 before that and up to and including right now? And that's the real question, because if we can understand why, perhaps we can make progress on stopping these things.
David Harris, our guest, author of the book we're talking about, A City Divided, Race, Fear, and the Law and Police Confrontations. And David, you're also a law professor in Pittsburgh. How did you get involved in this case and start exploring it in a way that detailed and dissected it so in your book, A City Divided?
Well, you know, it kind of happened right under my nose, almost literally, but not quite. I live just about a mile and a half, 2 miles from this spot where it happened. Pittsburgh is a real city, just like Milwaukee or Chicago, but it's small enough in scale that you could get a view of the entire dynamic of the case. I knew some of the players in the case. I was new to Pittsburgh at that time. I'd only been at the University of Pittsburgh for 2 years, but the whole thing was basically unfolding right in front of me. And I had access to all the proceedings and the players. It seemed to call out for somebody to examine it and examine it closely. I've done work in this field of police misconduct, police use of force, police search and seizure. This was my bread and butter. I'd done it for years. And to have this happening right in front of me at some point, it just jumped out at me and said, this is what you have to do. You have to begin looking at this.
It's a case study. And what we see, as you mentioned, David, happening over and over and over again. But you have 10 years of data now, but 10 years of data from this single story. And then you can, in your book, you contextualize it with, you know, a large part of the history of Pittsburgh and neighborhoods and how we interact with each other, depending on who we are. And through all of this, it goes back to this young man, Jordan Miles, who was a viola player at the Performing Arts High School, and these three undercover police officers. And so before we get to what we can do to sort of give us a perspective on the story as it stands today, David, what do you know about Jordan Miles and what happened to him after this night in 2010 and the three police officers involved? What happened to them after 2010?
Well, Jordan was first charged with the serious felonies, which were dropped in the first major court hearing in the matter. And after that, there were investigations, as I said, both at the federal level and the state level of the three police officers. They were suspended for a period of time. But 2.5 years later, no charges against the police officers. And if you think back to 2010, that was not unusual. It's highly unusual still in the United States to find police officers charged in any confrontation. And it was even more so then. So the case rolled on through two civil trials, which took a total of 6.5 years from the date of the incident. The police officers returned to policing. Two of them are still in the Pittsburgh Police Department. One of them left for a suburban department. They were returned to duty very early in the process. They had been suspended, but were returned. And Jordan had a great deal of difficulty. He had a scholarship to Penn State all lined up. When he tried to go to college, his PTSD and related conditions really kept him from succeeding. It was very sad. So his life changed. He didn't give up on himself, though. He kept going to school. He got a plumbing certification. And I'm glad to tell you that he now owns his own business in Pittsburgh. He's moved out of the city. He's been able to make a very good life for himself. He's a very shy and private person, always was, remains so now, doesn't want to be a public figure. But he found a way to get past this personally, to not have this define him. So he has a good life. As I said, not everybody survives these confrontations, and even those who do, it leaves marks on them.
Our guest is David Harris, the author of A City Divided, which dissects this story and everything that surrounds it in a very comprehensive way. He's also the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice and teaches criminal law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. So I understand you may have some questions for him about what works best and what hurts most when it comes to police reforms and how the community can make a difference in the community. 1-800-642-1234 to join us or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Fear, firearms, and law enforcement. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is a law professor and author whose latest book looks at the fallout and fight for reform following a black teen being left bloodied and bruised by three white police officers more than a decade ago. And this saga could offer some insight into what your community can do to keep guard against crime and keep the peace in the neighborhood. So what's your relationship like with the police? What role do you think race plays in that relationship? And do you think everybody's just afraid of everybody else? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email ideas at WPR.org. David Harris, our guest, author of A City Divided, and the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice, teaching criminal law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And David, you dedicate two different chapters to fear in your book, A City Divided. One about the fear of that police have, and one that a chapter about fear that communities of color have about the police. This seems to be an integral factor in dealing with stories like you do with Jordan Miles.
Well, it is, Lee. And fear, I doubt people would be surprised that there's a chapter in the book, or there's lots of discussion about the fear that people feel of police, particularly people who are people of color, brown and black people. There's a long history in this country of violence and use of force at much higher levels by police against black and brown people. We've seen it everywhere for a long time. And it's a well-established, statistically based assertion that I'm making, that those things are true and have been for a long time. So fear in those communities is not a surprise. And you actually find black and brown people much less willing to call the police when any of the rest of us would. Somebody's trying to break into their house. Somebody's stolen a car. They're not as likely to want to do that because they can end up on the wrong end of police suspicion. We know that black and brown parents talk to their kids when the kids get a driver's license about how to behave if and when they are stopped by the police, not because they need to be courteous and so forth, which of course the parents say, but because it's a survival situation. They don't want their kids to get shot. So that's not really a surprise. I think what's surprising to a lot of people is the role of fear in policing. And policing itself is a profession of bravery and courage. And nothing that I said in the book or will say now should take away from that. As President Obama said, I'll paraphrase, you know, police are the people who run toward the danger when the rest of us are running away. And that's true. But that doesn't mean that there isn't fear. The presence of bravery does not mean the absence of fear. It means conquering your fear somehow. And the way that's been done is through the warrior mindset and warrior-based training, turning the mindset of policing into it's a war. And we're the sheepdogs. We're the soldiers out there. And this is very, very detrimental to public safety. The idea planted in police training, both in the academy and later, that any encounter with a civilian, any encounter, is potentially lethal to the police officer until proven otherwise. And they should assume so. And that mentality is the way that they have overcome fear in policing, to be ready, as the trainers say, to use righteous violence in defense against people who would harm them or harm others.
Testimony of one of the police officers in the Jordan Miles case that he assumed everybody was suspicious or a potential suspect until he was able to prove otherwise? I think one of those police officers said just about the same thing in his defense.
Yeah. Yes. And not just suspicious, but potentially a lethal threat. Mm-hmm. And that is really not where we want domestic policing to be.
But is that in some way trauma informed? I mean, are we dealing with communities of trauma that are playing out their trauma in ways that is only furthering trauma in these communities? And that includes the police community?
Oh, I think that's a great point. It is really true. I don't think that in actual fact, statistically, that the trauma that police officers face from real lethal danger is nearly as present as they seem to think. I mean, policing can be a dangerous job, but it doesn't even make the top 10, to tell you the truth, of American jobs in danger. What we have is a culture that has grown up to say, danger's everywhere, death lurks around every corner, therefore you must be a warrior in your job, you must be ready to use lethal force. And so it's not a surprise that we go from that trauma, if you want to call it that, into an over-readiness, an over-willingness to use lethal force and sort the consequences out later. And this is all bolstered by the showing of these deadly videos that get circulated through police training all over the United States, caught on dash cams, sometimes on body cams, but those are newer, in which police officers are murdered or assaulted. And these are shown for the purpose of showing the new recruits and even others, this is what you're facing. I mean, you can take...
But you also have the viral videos on YouTube where the communities are shown with the police violence and then turn to neighborhoods and say, this is what you're facing. Let me reintroduce you. David Harris, professor of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law and the author of A City Divided, which is just so thorough in detailing what can and can't be done when it comes to police reforms or what we know, a roadmap for what works. Daryl in Germantown, good morning. You're on the Ideas Network with David Harris.
Good morning.
What do you think?
What I would like to say is that this reform that we're looking at right now is decades overdue. For too long, there's been a hidden, like a blue brotherhood way of secretly keeping secrets away from justice being served properly for victims that are confronted by police. And this mentality that the police carry around is not the victim's fault. It's their training. And if you're approach a victim on the street as someone that's going to harm you right away, there's no way to look at them any differently. And that's got to change. That mentality of that threat always being there has got to be changed.
Do you understand the fear, though, Daryl?
The fear I feel is actually being multiplied by how these police present themselves to a victim. They're the reason that fear actually exists. If they would treat people differently, I don't think that fear would be as present. That's in their mind. And that's the way they're trained. But that shouldn't be the responsibility of the victim on the street.
Daryl, I thank you for your perspective. And if you're not going to be a warrior as law enforcement officer David Harris, then what do you expect law enforcement to be on the streets?
Well, number one, I think Daryl's right on target in so many different ways that we can pick up on. But to answer your question, Lee, we have to move policing from a warrior mentality to a guardian mentality. Now, that's really well spelled out in the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing report. It came out in 2015 under President Obama. And you can also see it on the ground with Washington State. They are converting their training statewide into guardian-based training. And what that looks like is instead of the warrior crouching down, the warrior ready to use violence, these are people who communicate. These are people who de-escalate. These are people whose mission is not to preserve themselves and their comrades, but to serve the community, make the whole community safe, to stop and think and not react intensely and immediately, often with violence. So that was number one recommendation in that presidential task force report, and I would put it number one myself.
And as far as Daryl goes, when it talks about decades overdue and the unspoken code of police that needs to change, when we're talking about race, The City Divided, your book, David Harris, it makes clear that this goes back so far that it's difficult to get a handle on where you could go to make a change. How would you see step one? And we've only got a few minutes here before the news, but what's step one in dealing with racial bias?
Well, racial bias is ever present in our society, and anyone who does not think that is true, I think simply has their head in the sand. You have to first understand where it is and where it comes from. And the studies cited in the book make clear just how deep in the wiring this is for Americans, and not just white Americans, by the way. Seeing a black person triggers implicit and unconscious thoughts of violence, crime, and danger. The brain is actually tuned to be more sensitive to any hints of a weapon, things like that. We need training that tells police officers that black people and brown people are not necessarily a threat, and that puts them in those communities with people who are just there to live, have a good life, work their jobs.
Our guest is David Harris, and he is the law professor at the University of Pittsburgh and the author of A City Divided. I'm Lee Rayburn, and your calls are next at 1-800-642-1234. Do you trust the police? Do you fear them? Do they fear you? I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. How much do you think race has to do with the way you were assessed by law enforcement? It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent today. And when we say we've had the talk with our kids, what we mean can largely depend on the color of our skin. As our guest points out, for some of us, the talk is about the police. I'm fortunate that my talk is just birds and bees. I want to welcome and encourage you to share your police stories this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email our show ideas at WPR.org. We're up on Twitter at WPR Mornings, and our guest is David Harris. He is the author of A City Divided and the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. He teaches criminal law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And let's go to the phones where Matt and Nisita's waiting. Matt, good morning. You're on The Morning Show with David Harris. Matt, are you there? All right. Let's go to Patty in Birchwood. Patty, good morning. You're on the Ideas Network with David Harris.
Yes, good morning. And thank you for the good work, Professor Harris. 2 points I wanted to make. I listened to a black detective of 30 some odd years say that one reason for the increase in violence is the proliferation of guns in our country. He said years ago he could be called out to go to a robbery scene and not expect to find the offender with a gun. Now police go out and everybody's got guns and they've got assault weapons. So that's got to heighten police fear. I also think another reason why it's gotten so bad, here's politics, is we had a president who was one of the biggest bullies and name callers that I have ever witnessed in my 65 years of life, and really gave a lot of aggressive, militant thinking people permission to come out of the woodwork and act out. And I will listen off the air.
Patty, thank you for listening and thank you for calling. David Harris, what do you hear there?
Well, I want to say thank you to Patty for the thanks that she sent to me. I hear two important things there. Number one, the issue of guns is vitally important to all of the issues I covered in the book. And it is one of the key reasons that policing in the United States is different from almost any other country in the world. I mean, you can say a lot of things about American police, but they must be conscious in every encounter they have of the possibility that the person will be armed. Now, armed, not necessarily dangerous, but armed. And that's different from police in Japan, the UK, when anybody you encounter could be carrying a firearm. People carry other kinds of weapons in other countries, but it fundamentally changes what police do and what they have to train for. And until we get a handle on that equation, on how to get a grip on that problem, we will still have police thinking in those terms. I urged in my book that the police in their professional organizations and unions take up gun safety and gun control is one of their key issues. After all, they're the ones who are most often threatened by the presence of weapons. I'd like to see that. But it really is a difficult problem that we can't simply wish away. On Patty's other point, I don't know about unleashing the inner bully in the population as a whole. I've got my own thoughts about that. But for purposes of this conversation, what the last president did was he encouraged police violence. He validated it. I want everybody to remember a day in which the president, who was then holding office, that he addressed police on Long Island. And he very pointedly told them a little thing. He says, you know, when you guys put a suspect in a car and you put your hands over their heads so they don't bump their heads, you know, don't be so nice to them. I want everybody to remember that this was the same president, the same person who called for the execution of the Central Park five young black men who were wrongly accused and convicted of the Central Park rape case. He encouraged police use of force and even violence. So I think it was much more direct than just encouraging bullying generally in the population. I thank Patty for her comments.
And thank you, David. Let's go to Matt and Nasita this morning. Matt, good morning. You're on the morning show with David Harris.
Hi there. So I just want to say that I am very pro-police. However, what the guest is advocating for changing the culture of police training, I think, is valid. I was surprised to learn that policing is not in the top 10 most dangerous occupations in the United States. That was surprising to me. So changing the culture of their training, I think that has a lot of value. However, I can't really get over the sticking point for me that, A, if you're not breaking the law, and B, if you do have an encounter with the police, if you do what they tell you to do, there's a very, very small chance anything bad's going to happen to you as far as police violence. And with armchair quarterbacking now with these cell phone videos, I mean, I think that, police are going to not want to be police anymore because it's judge, jury, and executioner before the investigation's even over. And that's completely unfair. How many of these cases recently were police condemned for their actions when actually when the investigation was done, they were in the right.
Matt, thank you. Because it's a perspective, certainly, that we have heard before. If you are not doing anything wrong, then you have nothing to fear from law enforcement. And what's your reaction to that, David Harris?
Well, I agree with Matt that the culture of policing must change. We are in agreement there. But he's not right when it comes to the statement that if you're doing nothing wrong, nothing is going to happen to you. It is a fact of life. I can tell you, I've been interviewing people for decades. I've been interviewing African-American people in that time. And there is no guarantee when a black person encounters a police officer that simply complying and not having done anything is going to lead to a good, just, and fair outcome. In fact, they're much more likely to suffer a bad outcome when they were doing nothing wrong than a white person is. They're much more likely to have force used on them than a white person is. And those are facts. Those are very stubborn and really very disturbing facts, but they are facts. And because of that, the lingering distrust is both historic and present. Matt is right that the cell phone videos that are out there kind of amp the whole thing up because we don't always see the entire encounter. But the same is true in reverse when we see body camera footage that is used sometimes to justify police behavior. So I'd say we agree on the fact that the culture has to change. But believe me, it is no guarantee of fair treatment if you are black or brown. I wouldn't say that that's true of every police officer, every police department, not by any stretch. But this is why Jordan ran that night. I mean, even if you assume he knew that they were police, he can't be guaranteed as a young black man that he's going to come out without a beating.
And he didn't. David Harris is the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast, which looks at efforts to reform the criminal justice system, the author of A City Divided, which goes into this story of Jordan Miles in absolute detail, also a criminal law professor at the University of Pittsburgh, and your opportunity to ask about real fundamental police reforms, what works and what doesn't. In the decades since, Jordan Miles was arrested and then released by police, left bruised and bloodied and swollen. If you have questions about what we can do, what you can do, and how we can stay safe, 1-800-642-1234, where Julian from Wauwatosa is standing by. Julian, good morning. You're on the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Since being on listening on the air, like, the first thing is that is very true. Only white people can guarantee that if you do nothing wrong, that you can come out of the situation without having any adverse encounter. My family was one of the first black families in an area that was still predominantly white on the west side of Milwaukee near the Wauwatosa border. We had been there for 10 years when this incident happened. My cousin and I were patching the cement foundation on our garage. Two police officers pull up in the alley, guns drawn out the car, one with his shotgun, one with his sidearm. My cousin was already outside. I walked out of my basement with a bucket of cement and a trowel in my hand. And we're being yelled at to drop what we're doing because we're black in what was still a predominantly white neighborhood at the time. And this is the mentality of the Milwaukee PD. This is the mentality of America. So when people talk about we need to make change, we haven't even changed the fundamentals of America. Go spend 6 months in Mississippi and figure out what's different now than in the 50s, other than the signs are down. Nothing has changed that makes a great impact on the lives of black people in this country since the 1800s. The standards of living have changed for everyone in scale, but we're still at the bottom no matter how hard we try or how hard we don't.
How did this encounter change you?
I was 35 years old the first time I got let go for a traffic violation. 35 years old before the first time a police officer said to me, you can go ahead, don't do that again.
How would that encounter with the police at your house change you, Julian?
Unfortunately, it didn't, because that wasn't my first. I've had so many, I am the black person who didn't do everything right but stayed clean, and still have countless police stories. I stayed clean. I never did drugs, never sold drugs, was never part of any of that, and still couldn't escape it.
Julian, I want to thank you for the call and thank you for being a part of our community. And David Harris, being a part of a community can be a challenge.
Well, Julian's comments resonate with me. This is what I've heard over and over and over for years from black Americans. I mean, I think there's differences of opinion on whether or not anything has changed. But certainly in terms of dealings with the police, Julian's experiences are still sadly very, very common when you talk to black folks. Policing is done differently in black neighborhoods of comparable socioeconomic status to white neighborhoods. And when you have, as Julian was, a black person in a white neighborhood, they're treated as out of place and suspicious. And that leads to more police encounters. Until that changes, the fundamental distrust of police is going to be a fact. And that distrust is dangerous, not just for people like Julian, but actually for the police officers too. It leads to violence. It leads to all kinds of very, very serious consequences.
David Harris is the author of A City Divided and the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice, and we are running out of our time with him, so I'll give you the phone number one more time, 1-800-642-1234. What do you know about what works and what hurts when it comes to police reform? Our conversation continues next. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Our guest for the hour has been David Harris, and in his book, A City Divided, his very first bullet point under what we can do is to change the culture of law enforcement from a warrior mindset to that of a guardian. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest this hour is law professor, author, and podcast host who brings us a decade-long analysis of efforts at police reform in Pittsburgh. What do you want to know about before we're done this morning? What reforms do you believe will work where you are? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to join us, or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Frank in La Crosse this morning. Frank, good morning. You're on the morning show with David Harris.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. So I'd like the professor's perspective on what I consider as a longstanding point of contact that often end in tragic consequences, and that is the minor traffic violation that often results in the execution of the offender, the driver, for no good cause. And then the high-speed pursuit, which often endangers other public members not involved with it. So how do police change their approach to that? And my suggestion is don't pull over people for minor offenses that really don't impact the health, wealth, and safety of the public. And call off high-speed chases, because you're going to catch up with that offender through other technical means and a high-energy, high-pursuit speed. And related to that is the authority role, where police are trained to be judge, jury, and executioner, you know, and that all authority rests in their hands.
I don't believe that's their training, Frank, but the point is well taken about what to do when it comes to traffic enforcement and what that does to our the community's respect or understanding of law enforcement. David?
Yeah, I agree. I think that the stops for minor traffic offenses, there is no good reason that we need people with handcuffs, badges, and guns to be doing that. And those are often the occasion for intrusive kinds of questioning and investigation of people for which there is no probable cause or suspicion basis. Things like, do you have any drugs in the car? How about guns? Well, do you mind if I search your car? That sort of thing. These things are potentially dangerous. Traffic stops are among the more dangerous kinds of encounters that police officers initiate. And there's just no reason for any of this. Stop lights, stop signs, speeding, that stuff can actually all be automated. It could also be turned over to a civilian-oriented service to do that. One police department in Raleigh-Durham, I believe it is, has taken the step of just taking those very minor level traffic offenses, things like failing to stop or failing to use a turn signal, things like that, and just taking them off the platter for everyday police patrol. Those are no longer part of what they do, and that has resulted in a balancing of races, because what, of course, you find with the offenses being minor and the police doing them is that you get racial disproportion creeping in almost everywhere. On the subject of high-speed chases, those have just got to be limited. And more police departments are doing that. It's considered best practice now to have a line officer get permission from a higher up to engage in a high speed chase if it is not for a felony, things like that. Other departments are banning any high speed chases for non-serious, non-life-threatening offenders. They're waking up finally to the idea that these things kill people. I mean, they injure people, and it's not always the people in the car they're chasing. It's innocent bystanders, and it's even police officers themselves.
Let's go to Kevin in Stevens Point. Good morning, Kevin. You're on the air with David Harris.
Good morning. I'm a little bit upset that the factor of poverty, white poor people are also targets of police battery and mistreatment. I've been arrested several times. I've always been either a victim or just a bystander. And I find that the law has decided these situations all the way from small claims court to the Superior Court, where I've represented myself. They base their decisions not on the facts of the law, but on comparative social status. One example I'll tell you that I fought in federal court. I was minding my own business on my property in northern Wisconsin. Some DNR officers came, and because I was my appearance looked poor, they even on their statement said he looked poor because he had a van. Well, they said the probable cause was that the van looked in poor condition. The things I had outside looked like they, because of that, they suspected that my stuff was stolen. So they proceeded to roust me out of my van, chase me down, and beat me. And in response to that, they charged me with battery. So suddenly I was in jail, a victim of battery, being charged with battery. It was debilitating. And to, in order to remain sane, I spent the next year studying law and going to court.
Kevin, I appreciate your story. I want to. We're running out of time here. I want to get David Harris's reaction. And David, is justice what you can afford in America? And is that part of the reforms?
Oh, it has to be. Poor people are often marked for police attention in a way that others are not. And then the system further takes advantage of them by charging egregious fees and fines and all kinds of stuff. So there is something called criminal justice debt that people, even if they can get out of jail, even if they can raise the bail, which is a discriminatory process in itself, this is a huge burden that poor people carry in so many areas of our country, particularly in rural areas.
So, yeah, if we're going to lay out some reforms here, I also want to mention the use of force, which you mentioned in your book, A City Divided, Race, Fear, and the Law in Police Confrontations. What reforms need to happen when it comes to defining use of force with law enforcement, David?
Well, the Supreme Court of the United States laid down the standard for use of force under the Fourth Amendment decades ago, saying that it had to be measured under the under the perceptions of an objectively reasonable officer. And what we found in case after case after case is that this gives police officers far too much discretion in using force, and even deadly force. Instead, we have to move toward a system in which force has to not just be objectively reasonable, but necessary. And we look at all the steps an officer could have taken to de-escalate, whether the officer made things worse. Did they rely on distance, time, and cover to assure their safety and the safety of the public? Only when we get a better use of force standard will we start seeing less use of force, because police departments will have to train officers under that law. And that law doesn't have to come from the Supreme Court. It can come from state legislatures and even from city councils.
And what about transparency and accountability? The blue line has been mentioned this morning. And how do communities breach that blue line in a way that doesn't feel like we're violating our own law enforcement?
Well, you know, this is a huge issue, because people have little confidence in police discipline over misconduct of their own officers. Goes back to the time of the Romans. Who guards the guardians? And when we rely on the police to police themselves, we won't get good results. And when we make the whole process opaque, and I say when we make, because it's usually the result of state laws that govern this, make it inaccessible to the public, well, then the public doesn't know what happens. In most cities, people think police officers get away with misconduct all the time, because there's no way for them to find out if there's any discipline at all. And because there's no way, police departments often feel free to conduct investigations of their own officers and impose punishments that would not be acceptable if the public could see it. So that whole process has to be open to the public.
David Harris, thank you for this hour.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Lee.
David Harris is the author of A City Divided and the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. He teaches criminal law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer Kent this morning, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.